The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to The Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm talking this evening to Edna O'Brien about her novel, The Country Girls. Those of you who are used to The Guardian Book Club might know that we quite like to kind of go back to modern classics, and that this is often quite a sort of testing thing for our authors, who are not allowed to talk about their latest books, but have to talk about one that they published quite a long time ago. And until this evening, our record was, which you're breaking, Edna, was Doris Lessing, who came here and talked wonderfully about The Golden Notebook, which was first published in 1962. But the record is broken, because this evening, Edna O'Brien is going to be asked about a book that was published 48 years ago, incredibly, The Country Girls, which first appeared in 1960, which I think is fantastically game of her, apart from anything else. And if you'll all forgive me for being a little autobiographical, it's also a bit of a memory trip for me as well, because this book and several others by Edna O'Brien, including the two sequels to this one, were rather part of my adolescence. And this may be true for one or two other people here, and perhaps not quite so sharply true as it was for me at my monastery boarding school, where in my mid-teens, I read these books to sort of find out what girls were like. I had a rather bookish approach to that sort of inquiry.
Sure enough.
Ah, well, that's good. And so for me, going back to The Country Girls, and I've been quite swotty, I've reread the other two in the series as well, was a sort of, an extraordinary kind of personal recollection too. And I was thinking this leads into the first thing I wanted to ask you, Edna, because I was thinking when I was reading The Country Girls in particular about what lots of people here must know about, and what I think quite a lot of us heard you talking about on Desert Island Discs actually recently, which was sort of the furore caused by the publication of this novel and it being anathematized, as it were, by the church in Ireland, and I think banned. I was rereading it and thinking both of that and of the frisson that I got when I was 15, reading it. And I suppose what sort of surprised me slightly was that. Not that it was much less sort of shocking, of course, than I had thought it was when I read it as a teenager. And I don't mean that just in the trivial sense that we might live in more liberal times and the County Clare website has a picture of you, mm-hmm. up on it now, you know. Come to County Clare where The Country Girls is based, you know, it's a tourist thing now. It's not just that, but also actually thinking of my own memory of it, that it seemed the way that it was written, I'd misremembered it, I think. And the way that it was written seemed sort of very carefully to follow the not to be a sort of worldly reflection on the place and the climate that the characters came from, but seemed actually itself to sort of follow the innocent thoughts and feelings of Caitlin in particular, the narrator of it, and I wondered if you remembered sort of, because you wrote it when you were in your late 20s, married with two children, living in London, but it seems to kind of re-inhabit the girl's head very much.
No, that's a big long question.
Sorry. that's the only long one I do, okay. Honestly. I did my introductory question with Graham Swift and he said, "Have you finished? Have we got to the question?"
You know, writing is from the unconscious. The judgment, the assessment, the banning, the non-banning, the liking, the disliking, the resume, everything else is conscious. So I sat down, having been given this famous sum of £50 from an English and American publisher to write, because I read readers' reports for publisher Hutchinson. And I was rather ambitious with my readers' reports, and sometimes rather acerbic. So they were under the illusion that I could write a novel. They paid me the £50, which I spent at once, as is my wont. And I sat down, and this is truly the truth, so therefore it's difficult for me to answer your question in maybe the way you would wish the answer, but I can't do that. I sat down and I began. I wakened quickly and sat down in bed. Awakened quickly and sat up in bed abruptly. It is only when I am anxious that I waken easily. And for a minute I could not remember, then I did, the old reason my father had not come home. That, now to me, writing is, and as a reader and as a writer, is a state of spell. Whether the spell is vitriolic or lyrical or anything else doesn't matter. So long as the writer sustains that spell and the reader, hopefully, it becomes the reader's spell. So to answer part of your question, I wasn't thinking, nor could I, or I would have written a different kind of book. I wasn't thinking of Ireland at that time or the landscape. It was all inside me. If I needed a girl to walk along a road, or a man for that matter, to be at the end of that road, that was already there in my psychic landscape. So I think writing at its best is like dreaming. And that's why it's not always as easily accessible to open discussion, because the magic of what makes something work is not tangible, is not logical. It's logical insofar as the sentences are. So what I had been influenced by and permeated by, for instance, Sigmund Freud, if he read, which I would love to think he might, if he were on earth, that book, he might say, ah, yes, that author's family, not romance, but family tragedy is my father. He had not come home. So with every book, and with The Country Girls, we'll keep with it, you or any other person reading it can find the particular narrative or motif that you're looking for, if you're going to analyze it, or for that matter, review it. However, when one is reading a book, when I, as a reader, am reading, I receive it in a different way. Not necessarily emotional, not necessarily intellectual, but in the sense of entering that world. And when I started to write, and I wrote it in this, oh, so enviably short time. Now they take years. And then it took weeks.
And is that true? It only took...
Oh, absolutely.
What, how many weeks did it take?
Less than three. In a state of extreme and perilous emotion. Not that emotion must spill into the work, but it must be underneath the work, that emotion, that longing for mother, father, country, love, all those things. A lot of literature, and the literature that I admire, is about longing. It's not cynical. I detest cynicism. But we've come to that perhaps later. And in the writing of it, I felt that I literally, as I think I've said in something I wrote to you or for you, that I was the messenger, really. The words came to me, and the place came to me, and each scene came to me, as if I could just, they came in. The aftermath is quite different. Why it created the bit of it wasn't a bit really, it was a lot of ructions that it did, was, I would say, I would put it down to three things, maybe four. There had not been a tradition of women writers. There also, I come from, and glad I do, with some reservations, which we all have about everything in our lives, from a very narrow, claustrophobic, and judgmental religious community. Of course, everyone was judging everyone else. Everyone, did you see her go to Holy Communion? Did she not go? She went, he went, a lot of men went to the altar, but didn't take the host. So they went, so as their mother could see, they went up to the altar, but they backed away from that thing. So some of it was that I had written, or seemed to write, what was just a diary. You know, there was just a straight off account of da-da-da. Well, it wasn't quite as simple as that. But because I was a woman, and because I wrote in this apparently revelatory or confessional style, that was two reasons. That's two. The third is Baba, whom I would love to be. I'm sick of being polite, nice, amenable, and all that. At heart, Baba did say the odd swear word, etc. And they, in their, you used the word innocence the other day in your column when you wrote about it. They were innocent rebels. And since you wrote your piece and I read it very carefully, I've been looking up a lot, and apparently many people, Alex Ross in The New Yorker, a wonderful music critic, said about, sorry to get very, very, in very high company here, said that Mozart was forever renewing his lost innocence. And I think every creator, in whatever level they are, that it is so important, and more than that, it's the fertility, is the innocence, and what you, how you see things with new eyes. Not because they're going to make it sensational, but because you're going to make it as if it was not ever seen before. So what angered people was, and the Archbishop of here in Westminster, the Archbishop of Dublin, talking this codology, I could use a more obscene word, but as we're in company, I'll try not to, about the dirt in this book. And it's a pity. It upset and unnerved me at the time. Of course it did, because writing is no easy task. It isn't. And you're always fearful that you will not make it work. It's like holding a fetus in your mind and bringing it to life. So I was very, very upset. And in retrospect, I was angry. And now I think, by God, a whole lot of brouhaha about what happened. But it did offend because people, we're all capable of it. So there are a lot of mea culpas in life, including myself. People are hypocritical, you know. They're either socially hypocritical or religiously hypocritical or politically hypocritical. That's why, for instance, I could never be a politician, because I sometimes would agree with my opposing side. And it shocked because it seemed clear and naked. And I'm glad of that.
I mean, you talk about clear and naked. I was remembering when I first read it that one of the things somebody from Edna's publishing company is here this evening, and this very handsome, beautiful new jackets for the new editions of it. And I think some of you here might remember the original Penguin, well, not original, actually, of course, they're 1970s, which is when I read it, but the Penguin paperbacks, which had these kind of, I hear they're design classics, and for me, they were very, very intriguing, and they were sort of pictures of part not a sexual part, but a part of a woman's body, a curve of a woman's body, and you could see the puckering of the skin, or the sort of, you practically see, and it was kind of fascinatingly sort of.
I think it missed the ball.
Yes, well, it was very promising, but I read reading.
One of the
things about the Country Girls, which I'd forgotten, and perhaps partly because of these covers, is of course that actually, there isn't any sex in it. There isn't any.
There's the hope for it.
But
a suggestion.
Yeah. But
it's much more erotic.
I know. I mean, it's a sort of. It would be a good quiz question to ask when, at what stage in the three novels, because they are a sort of trilogy, in what stage in the three novels, Caitlin, who narrates the first two but not the third one, actually has her first. Actually has sex for the first time. It's actually page 177 of the second book. So you have to, and that was published 2 years after the
and
first.
And it wasn't
so
a big deal either.
Yeah. That is also true.
To go back to the covers, those, they were so absurd, those covers.
But they were beautiful. They were beautiful covers.
Well, I'll tell you, I was in the underground, the tube, with my son, who was whatever age he was then, and there was a man opposite us reading one of them, I forget which one of the three, with the famous pink tinted naked covers. He closed the book quickly. He read a couple of pages, and my son said to me, you know, he said, what's wrong with the covers? People buy that book expecting one thing.
Yes.
I was right, because I saw it. I saw the action of just impatience. And I wanted to say, oh, look, your soul is what I want to read. I didn't.
Well, can I ask you one question now about the sexual longing in it, which I think it's... I suspect that at the time, those people who took offence or chose to take offence that it probably weren't very specific in their criticisms. But it struck me rereading it that there was one thing I hadn't really noticed first time or even second time, because I think I read it two or three times back in the 70s, which now seemed quite, not shocking, but quite sort of electric and quite a dangerous theme, which is that Mr. Gentleman, I wanted to ask him about it, because Caitlin becomes, you'll correct me if this isn't accurate, but she becomes fascinated by him, and it seems at first partly because of his remoteness, his elegance, his wealth, he's cultured, and he becomes interested in her, and he becomes interested in her when she's quite young, really. Yeah. And the first, and of course, you said you wrote it very quickly, and I wrote in my column with sort of unerring technical control, Ed and Rover, you know, but you just,
good.
Well, anyway. Anyway, I think it was unerring, but you slowly become aware of her awareness, it seems to me, of him, and of him sort of being interested in her and looking at her, you know, and it's brilliantly done, but it's also quite unsettling, because I think when you become really aware that there's some reciprocation is when he takes her to Limerick to get her, and it's to get her school uniform, you know, and she's getting her school uniform, and it's all sort of tights and gym slips. And okay, he doesn't go with her, but he takes her out to lunch and gives her wine, and she says, I'd have preferred lemonade. And so you are very deliberately reminding us that she is, I think, is she 14, something like that?
Around
that. And that.
Give or take.
And there's something quite, which I hadn't got at all, which is also perhaps partly to do, well, it's partly to me being older, but maybe also changing, a different kind of changing climate. And I became quite aware of him as not a threatening person, but he's sort of, it's going to end up when she's 18, with him sort of proposing that they actually consummate this relationship. But he first starts showing an interest in her when she's very young and a sort of schoolgirl and very naive, and I found that quite, yeah, it's quite unsettling in retrospect.
Ah, I wonder, what unsettled you?
Well, that she's very young, I suppose.
But it's not Lolita. It's not a
psychologically it's more interesting than that. I'm not saying you're better than Nabokov, but it's psychologically it's more interesting because she seems quite sort of dimly aware of him. But she does say, I noticed she comes back from the convent after a first term and she says, I think, oh, I noticed he was looking at my nice plump leg. And she says, oh, I met him in town. He said he was coming for petrol, but he was lying. And it seems to me that it's not the older Caitlin looking back years later from some worldly vantage point saying, now I see what he was up to.
It's the character at the time. Yes.
And I knew he was going to kiss me, and I knew he was going to say he loved me. And I suppose it's peculiar because it feels like not that he's going to sort of pounce on her when she's 14, but that he's sort of, yes, cultivating her in some way.
Well, I think it's the parallel to people, because none of us know anyone, even the people we think we know, anyhow. Our inner life is far more complicated and ambivalent and so on and so on, what we manifest. So it's two people for whom this unexpressed attraction or passion is vibrant. It's there. How it's going to be or not going to be consummated actually doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter in more recent types of fiction, that's what happens in the first 3 minutes, so there's no time left for anything else, which is a pity. I think, however, I would like to say, when they go to Limerick and everything, but the moment in that chapter that makes it, and there is some stolen idea from my master, James Joyce, many people's master, is when they're driving back, they've been through the day, she's had mulligatawny soup, tasted this wine, which was bitter. I no longer think that, alas. I wish I had lemonade, I would save a lot of money. And then she says, the snow fell soft and oblique against the windscreen. His hand came off the steering wheel. It was cold, it was something like marble. And it's that moment when that touch of the hand is as great in her universe and his as something more physically completed or robust. But what it is for her and for him, except he has been in love more than once, is the moment she, and that beautiful word which we must never forget, when she fell in love. Joyce said, first we feel, and then we fall. And it's that what from, again, when I was writing it, I didn't think, oh, I am going to work up to that moment when that journey ends in that climax. But if now and then I have to look at the book, or I've just done a stage play which opened in San Francisco from the book with music and songs and ribaldry, even wilder, I hope. It's that matters to me. Maybe every reader is different. I mean, the way you will read a book, any single person here will differ from the person next to you, which is what makes us want to read books and makes reading such both a private and an imaginative thing. Jean-Paul Sartre said, I think it was a little extreme, but there's truth in what he said. He said, to read a book is to write it. Now, Gogol wouldn't agree. Neither would James Joyce or Faulkner. But I know what Sartre meant, to enter into that world. And that world in that time, for me and for everyone, it was tentative. But I'd like to say one thing in terms of the world we live in. I don't go around with the census board stopping people in the street to ask them. But I think that tentativeness, that imagining of loving someone and almost reaching them is in people's sensibility to this day. Otherwise, life would be so prosaic, wouldn't it? Or am I?
No, absolutely. Well, I agree. But that's why I in a way, unrealistically, sort of read the book as being a sort of conscious, which is clear from your account, it's not conscious attempt not to write, as it were, with the knowledge you must have had and your experience in life you must have had by the time you wrote it.
Let's take
the religion, for instance. I just wanted to ask you something about that, because the religion, again, may be part of the offence that it caused. And of course, the girls, but it's Baba's idea, don't they? They write this terrible thing. And what, of course, it's characteristic of the book, you don't actually find out exactly what the terrible thing is. You get the first three or four words.
The insinuation.
Yes, you get one of the nuns starts reading it, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And what does it say? It says, Father Tom put his long... Stuck his long thing, it says. And then the nun goes into apoplexy. Yeah. But it's characteristic of these.
Well, it brings the woman in as well, into sister Mary. It just says that.
Yes.
So we know.
Yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
What are we going to say about that?
Well, that about the religion, that one of the things which seemed to me so delicate about the book, really, was that although right at the end, Caitlin says that she's stopped going to Mass.
To confession.
Yes, to confession. But for the most part, she actually, you manage to make her at one and the same time a kind of rebel, I suppose. But actually, she also, I mean, it's so infused in her that she still, you know, she thinks, there's a brilliant bit, I think, when she's thinking about her, she's at the convent and being told about purgatory, and she thinks about her mother, and she worries about the space of time between her mother last going to confession and drowning. She dies in the course of the novel, and what she might have done in that space of time. And maybe she went to purgatory, even though she was a good woman, and she remembers a time when they were given the wrong change in a shop, and she said to her mother, "Oh, we've got the wrong change, we've got too much change," and her mother didn't go back. And
a little sin.
And this is not a narrator sitting, you know, sitting in a years later in a sophisticated city and thinking, oh, what a. It actually narrates it as though you're right in her head, and that would be naturally what she would think. And there are lots of examples like that where the religion, contrary to what all those people might have said in 1960, where her religious instincts seem very much respected, actually, in the novel.
Well, again, I think it would be that haunted by, as we all are, we're haunted by what we're first brought up in our thinking, our religion, whether we abdicate or renege on it or stay with it, it stays with us. And I was brought up in the most absolutely undeviating Roman Catholic environment, both in the home, every holy picture, you know, every holy picture had blood. I mean, the blood image was always, and the sacrificial image And I remember one day going to Limerick. I very seldom went to Limerick, but for some reason I was in Limerick. And I always felt wherever I went, I would have to go into a church, say a prayer. I mean, don't ask me why there isn't. This is more about fear than faith, except I did it. And I was in this chapel in Limerick where, you know, there are all these statues, all painted by Italians who had come to Ireland. A few Italians did all the Stations of the Cross, all the Bleeding Sacred Hearts, all the Maid of Erin. They were all extremely gory,
yes.
Which Italian Catholicism is
yes.
not.
Yes.
So I'm sitting in this chapel in Limerick, begging God for some favour. I crossed my legs. And a woman who was doing the stations, you know, they're lined along the wall, 14 stations, 7 one wall, 7 the other, taps me on the shoulder. And she said, "I wish you to know that Our Lady blushes each time a woman crosses her legs." And I would have thought, in retrospect, now this is me, the older Edna, I didn't have the gumption at that time to think, well, it's a state of modesty, legs closed rather than. But at that time, as I only bring it up as an example of the suffusion of religion, or really pseudo-religion, or the tributary aspect of religion into every second of one's life. But then there is the religion itself and the fear. I would say that that fear that I was inculcated in, a fear of eternity, eternal life, hell. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned purgatory, because it's not as bad as hell, but I think hell could be true as well.
True.
That is there, and nothing, Richard Dawkins, whoever else writes, you know, they write these things, I read them. But what you've been breastfed, brain fed, and fed is always in you. And logically, I think about eternity, and I know the two words I was taught, "Come ye all my blessed, and possess my kingdom, or depart from me, you hell." I know them off by heart. I said them every night as a child. Now, my grown self, if I have to any extent matured, would say to oneself, "Well, there's not going to be enough room for all the people in the universe." And yet, the religion, fear, and what Nietzsche said, I didn't know he said it, but when I read it, I thought that's absolutely true for some people, and I'm one of them. If God did not exist, man would have had to invent him. And it is true. We do fear. I mean, Shakespeare even did. Shakespeare, the greatest writer ever, talks of that hilly burn from which no traveler returns. So that is in us. And in my particular situation, it was coupled with religion rather than just the supernatural or the mystery of a god or a being or a something that made us from animal, from stone to animal to humans. And one of the things that I'd like to ask God, if he were to, you know, what's the word, bless me with a little visit, would be, there's many things, but there's one thing in particular, this is going off the track, but we'll come back in a moment, is dreaming. How did man and woman and child, where, in what part, how could dreaming come from matter, the development of matter? So religion is always part of my consciousness, part of my fear, and in one small way, part of, I would like to see, I'd never thought I'd say this or say it in public, I'd like a little more religion and a little less brash hedonism in the world we live in. I'd like to donate my conscience to a few people, because religion does give you a conscience.
Well, I was going to say, more than one person has said, it's not an original thing of insight of mine, more than one person has said
that religion is or can be quite an advantage, quite specifically for a novelist. I mean, not just for any writer, but for a novelist, that it can give, you know, lots of people point out how many wonderful sort of 20th century US, but also, you know, actually English. Yeah, why all those English novelists converting to Catholicism?
Converts.
Yeah, well, because they knew they needed something to write novels with, you know. Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene, Muriel Spark, they needed it for their novels. So,
shall I tell you something? It's easier to be a convert.
You think?
Yes, because you don't have
hellfire. There's a rather glamorous girl at the convent, isn't there?
And Lydia.
Yeah, and Caitlin says she was half Swedish and her mother was a convert. And like, there's a world, you know, that's it. You don't want anything else about her background, but that's it. There's
convert.
You know, what an extraordinary exotic background she must come from.
Well, what it is, with just the converts for one moment, I don't think Graham Greene, I met him a few times, but there's no need to dilate on that. I don't think that have the same fear. They haven't the fear of the actual. Joyce had the fear.
Yes.
I mean, that sermon in Portrait of the Artist is scalded alive. And the fear is the opposite to faith, because fear edges out faith. Because it's because of the fear you go into the chapel in Limerick, or because of the fear of this, that, and the other. Faith itself must be the most beautiful thing, because it's faith.
Yes.
It's believing. Faith in people, faith in anything, faith in literature.
But it's also a matter, isn't it, of in a novel, rather than what you might actually believe now or believed at the time. It does seem to give a kind of, I mean, in some simple ways, it gives a kind of voltage to things. You know, every time Baba says, "For Christ's sake," you know, you can feel a sort of little discharge. But there's also these kind of, I was looking at this, this is in the grocer's shop in Dublin. So you're not allowed to read the book out, but I can. And because you remember it all anyway. And it says, and Willie, who's the messenger boy, and it says this simple thing, "On a postcard, I wrote down the prices of obvious things like tea and sugar and butter, and the morning dragged on slowly until the Angelus rang. Willie laughed while he was praying. Mm-hmm. Then he took a pin-up girl out of his pocket and said, 'She's like you, Miss Brady.' I was 4 or 5 years older than Willie, so I didn't mind what he said." Now, the Angelus, as I said to my wife, "Do you know what the Angelus is?" And she's read this novel, and she said, "No, I've no idea." And I think lots of people in England will have read it and not know what the Angelus is, or what postulants are, or a novena, or lots of these things. But the Angelus, of course, this bell rung, and you're supposed to...
At 12 o'clock.
Yes.
And
you're supposed to think of the mystery of the Incarnation.
Yeah, the angel of the Lord declared unto Mary.
Yeah, and it
seems... conceived with the
and
Holy
it seems
Ghost.
And it's a wonderful sort of... because
it's beautiful language as well.
Yes.
I have to say, I grew up in a community with... about the books, no books at all. One copy of Rebecca, as I've often told it, or loaned, but not consecutively by the page. So you've got page 84 and then page 2, etc. But the language of in the prayer books and the Gospels, you know, it's quite beautiful. It's commanding, it's real language instead of dross, you know. And the Angelus was one, it was twice a day, 12 and 6. It's still, even in old Celtic Tiger developed Ireland, it's still on RTE television.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
Seems a great example of the sort of, because you mentioned the Angelus, and I would absolutely bet that the majority of non-Catholic British readers will have read it and sort of not really know what it is, and yet it seems a kind of a Willie there who laughs while he says it, but he says it still, and it seems a sort of example of what I was trying to say about the novel, that the religion which the characters are either wrestling with or perhaps in the end losing or rebelling against gives a kind of strange spine to their stories.
Yes, yes.
You know,
it gives a spine both to hold on to it and to fight against it. It's two things, because it is strangling.
Yes.
It is making everything forbidden. So it gives a double strand. But the Angelus and the language of Gospels and, you know, oh, commiserate me, oh, Lord, compassionate me. I mean, they were beautiful. They were like Elizabethan language. So I'm afraid, among my many other things that the Bishop Center and the others accused me of, was that I mixed up language, religious language, with literary language, and I mixed up Mass and the ritual of Mass when it was in Latin, and flowers and white linen and candles with theatre. This isn't exactly devotional. There's devotion in it,
yeah,
but there's worldliness in it as well. And Kafka said a wonderful thing, well, he said many wonderful things in his short, extraordinary mind, extraordinary life. He said, writing at its best is a secret act of criminality. Mm-hmm. And in my own little way, when I wrote The Country Girls and the trilogy and then an epilogue 20 years later, which is much more audacious, I was rebelling while at the same time carrying in my mind and in my being all the landscape and people of that world. So there's a little bit, it's both. It's not like take Flora Thompson's Lark Rise to Candleford, which is a book set in the country. She loves the landscape and the country that she wrote about. I, because of this particularly stringent upbringing, not just from my own family, but from the whole world around me, and the convents and nuns and everything, because they were also conditioned by their experience. And when my mother was so outraged and hurt and grievously ashamed of my book and inked out the words on it, she herself was appalled by it, as the result not only that other people were reading it and saying to her, your daughter, etc., but that it went against all her given principles. Maybe not her secret principles, because that is the rather amazing thing about us as human beings. There's more to us than we let on. There is, and that's good. That's good. If we were just on one note, on one track, we would be very... So religion as a stimulus and as something to both be part of and fight against is very good for a poet or a novelist. It is. Not good for life. But I have never myself thought that writing is a suitable occupation for a happy life. It is. It couldn't be. It is insanity to think that one might sit for hours, days, or weeks, as Gustave Flaubert did, to try and accurately get that moment of a sky or a sea or someone sitting on a chair or getting up off a chair. It's not normal. It's not normal. But we do it because we must. And as readers, and I'm a reader, and a voracious reader, mostly of older literature, because it has more sap in it. I love sap within the construct of the story. It is something, there is a need in us for John Donne's poetry or for any line of Shakespeare, whether we know those lines or not, but there is a need in us for that which is richer, deeper, and everything, I can't think of the other words, than ordinary life.
Edna and I agreed beforehand, actually, she's the first writer who's come to the book club to do so, that we would explicitly look forward to the glass of wine we were going to have afterwards. And I think that she's entertained and amused us long enough, we should let her have it. And anybody, will you sign some books afterwards?
Yes, of course.
And just to say thank you so much for coming and talking
to us. Thank you all.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.